from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, how do you know if you or someone you know is a narcissist? It's a potentially serious question and is the subject of a new book by a local therapist. Also, what role did California really play in the UN climate change conference in Copenhagen? And comic Suzanne Westenhofer. She was the first openly lesbian comedian on American TV. First, the Winter Paralympic Games are underway in Vancouver, and a Davis man, a former medalist himself in downhill skiing, was part of the U.S. delegation for the opening ceremony. Mike May has been blind since he was three. He's also an entrepreneur and runs a company that makes GPS for the visually impaired. He's in our studio. Mike May, welcome to Insight.
Thrilled to be here.
How was the weather in Vancouver? The relative lack of snow was an issue in the Winter Olympic Games. Are the ski slopes in better shape now?
There was quite a bit of snow falling when we were there. In fact, the downhill course, which was the same one run by Lindsey Vonn and Julie Mancuso and so forth, ran into the same difficulties. It was fogged in, and after 2 hours, they postponed that until another day. So it was foggy, but there was more snow.
I was checking the medal tables, and the U.S. is not doing so well so far in the Paralympic Games, at least compared to in the Olympic Games, just two medals and in 10th place. Why is that, you know?
Well, when I was there at the biathlon and some of those cross-country events, the Russians and the Ukrainians were amazingly strong. They were all the top racers, and so I think that the U.S. in those sports that are traditionally won by people from those countries and Scandinavia, I think the fact that the U.S. has pulled any out is actually quite good.
Yeah, and I guess the Russian athletes can sleep a little sounder at night because when they came back from Vancouver from the Olympic Games, the president and the prime minister didn't seem too happy with things.
Yeah, they'll let these guys go back.
You competed in the Paralympic Games yourself. Tell us when and what you did.
Well, in the 80s, it hadn't quite evolved to being simultaneous with the other Olympics. So in 1982, it was in Switzerland, where I won three gold medals and introduced the technique of the guide going in front of the blind skier. All of the other teams had the guide behind. And it's when I came back for the next Winter Games, the Paralympics in Austria in 1984. In fact, everybody had switched, and I was beaten by a guy from Austria and a Canadian, so I took three bronze.
Well, that's not too bad in itself.
It was great to be a pioneer and to change the technique, which is what they're using today. There are three visually impaired skiers on the U.S. team, and they're all going with a guide in front.
You were totally blinded when you were very young, so you could not have started skiing when you had sight. How did you get started skiing?
Well, actually, we started our boys skiing when they were two, so it's possible, but
yes.
Highly unlikely. And I didn't ski, in fact, until I was 27 years old, a student at UC Davis. All of my friends were going and tried to convince me, but I just never made time for it. But once I got out there on the slope, I was hooked. It was such an amazing feeling to fly down the mountain with just the sound of the guide skis and their voice to guide you down. And as you ski more, you get better, you go faster, and you learn to ski anywhere, anytime.
My guest is Mike May. He was a delegate to the opening ceremony of the 2010 Paralympic Games in Vancouver. He's a skier and a Paralympics medalist. He's also CEO of his own company in Davis that makes GPS for the blind. How has skiing for blind and visually impaired people different today than when you started out? Are there technologies, techniques around today that weren't around when you started?
Well, the main thing that changed was the business of the guide going in front. The other thing that's changed is, in fact, there are fewer people competing today than there was in the 80s. And that's an unfortunate byproduct of the fact that we're trying to have an equal playing field and there's a factor system. And it's pretty tough for a totally blind skier to ski on the same course as, let's say, a one-armed amputee who has a complete vision. And in the effort of the U.S. Olympic Committee to try to make everybody ski on the same courses and train on the same courses, unfortunately, I don't think as many people qualify today. So it's the good news and the bad news. In terms of technology, which I love and embrace throughout my life and in so many different ways, in fact, in skiing, I think the best strategy is to be about 3 feet behind your guide and to listen to them closely. And I don't find speakers or headphones or any kind of electronic thing to be helpful.
What was it like for you seeing the 2010 games get started? I assume that you think back to your own experiences as a competitor, but What's the turnout like at the Paralympic Games today compared to how it was in the past in terms of the audience and the athletes and also the sports being played?
Well, it's amazing to have the Paralympic Games at the same venue, have all the same facilities and resources that the other Olympics had. And we didn't have a full medical facility and cafeteria and an athlete's village. And we were fortunate enough as part of the White House delegation to go through and meet the athletes in their break rooms and in their facilities. And I'm thinking we were in hotels. We didn't have anything special. So it's great to see that they have all of these facilities and resources to now. And I think that also helps in terms of the quality of the athletes and the competition that they engage in. It's amazing throughout the different venues to see the blind skiers, the sledge athletes, the curling athletes in wheelchairs. And Jeffrey, every one of these athletes has an amazing story. You could do a whole segment easily with each one of them that is absolutely inspiring to me.
I read that for the opening ceremony, the BC Dome in Vancouver was sold out, 60,000 people. It must have been quite an atmosphere there.
Unbelievable. And to have Rick Hansen and Terry Fox and his parents, these are athletes that are known as well as Wayne Gretzky and any other famous Canadian athlete. And Rick Hansen was there. I got a chance to spend some time with him. And these guys are just phenomenal. And the crowd, the Canadians that were there to support them and the artistry of the whole event was, I've heard, as good or better than the other Olympic opening ceremony.
On your travel blog from Vancouver, you wrote about sledge hockey, which is like ice hockey, but the athletes are on sledges careening around the the rink. And you got to try out a sledge yourself.
Oh, they're crazy. They're crazy. And the guys that don't have legs have a certain advantage because their sleds are shorter. They can get into corners. They can go faster. The guys with legs are heavier, and they can add a little bit of weight to the collisions. And these guys are just as crazy as any able-bodied hockey player out there, just going for it as much as you can imagine and zipping around on the ice. But, of course, they're only a few inches off the ice.
Mike May, former Paralympics medalist himself in skiing. He was a delegate just back from the early days of the 2010 Paralympic Winter Games in Vancouver. You lost your sight totally when you were age 3, but you have part of your sight back. Could you tell us how you lost your vision and how you got some of it back?
I lost my vision from a chemical explosion and never thought of getting vision as anything that was going to happen or it was a possibility. And so I just got on with life, learning to deal with things in terms of the adaptive tools and techniques that any successful blind person really needs to have. It came about that a stem cell and cornea transplant was available to me in 2000, and I had the surgery and got some vision back, but it's a strange hybrid vision because I hadn't had vision all these years. My brain doesn't process the information, even though the eyeball is sending the signal. There's a bottleneck. I can see motion and color quite well. I can't see any details. I still use a dog or a cane to determine the steps or the things that are in front of me.
I wonder, does that new level of vision help or hinder you when you're skiing compared to when you were totally blind?
When I got the vision back, it took me at least a year or two to ignore the vision, because when I would see a dark shape, I wouldn't know if it was a tree, a shadow, a person, a hole. And there's a big difference between those things when you're coming at them. And if you're distracted or if you tense up when you're skiing and going at a pretty good speed, you're just going to end up falling down because you can't continue your skiing very well. So I had to detune and ignore that information, and the sight actually got in the way initially.
Along with your skiing and your Paralympics competition and your entrepreneurial work, you started out in your career working for the CIA. Doing what?
Can't tell you. I was a political risk analyst on Africa.
How did you get into that?
I was going to Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and the CIA came recruiting, as they do to many colleges. And I thought, well, what a lark. I'll apply. You know, I'll be the first blind guy to work for the CIA. And one thing led to another, and it actually turned out to be a fascinating experience. It taught me a lot about writing. It was great.
And then you got into business, and now you're the CEO of your own company, which is based in Davis, and you developed the first accessible GPS for the blind. Tell us about that.
Well, getting around better and knowing about my environment has always been something that's been important to me. And when I had the opportunity with technology to develop that for myself and for other blind people, I formed this company along with some other blind folks, and we came out with the first GPS for the blind, and it's evolved a lot over 10 years. And the main difference between that and the GPS that people are familiar with in their cars or on their Blackberries is that it talks a lot more. When I'm walking down a street, I want to hear that I'm passing Starbucks or I'm passing the Real City Cafe or whatever it is. You can see with your eyeballs what that business is. I can't. Therefore, I'm having my technology announce it. Same thing when it comes to the intersections. And then the GPS does all the standard things as well in terms of telling you when to turn. And this is as a pedestrian or in a vehicle.
What a transformation that must be.
It's amazing. What the beauty of it is that it gives you the opportunity to get lost. Lots of people tell me to do that figuratively, but I enjoy doing. I can now get unlost. You can drop me or any of our blind users around the country, around the world, any place, and we can find our way out. And I actually am typically the guide or the navigator for my wife Jennifer, or for a taxi driver, whomever. If they're getting lost, I'm helping to direct things. A funny story in Vancouver is we were going out to dinner with the U.S. ambassador to Canada and the security people and the driver in the front. And they're trying to figure out where this restaurant was. And I'm thinking, now, do I tell them where it is? Because I'm seeing on my Braille display where to turn. Or is it the diplomatically correct thing to do to keep my mouth shut and let them find it? And I figured, you know, guys with guns, you kind of let them take over and be in control.
I'm sure some people listening to this are astonished that a GPS device could not only know where you are on the earth, but know what building is right next to you. Is there a simple way to explain how that process works?
There's a massive database of the map information and then another one of the points of interest. There's 15 million so far in the database. So it's simply a matter of every latitude, longitude that you're at. This spot right here is specifically in the studio, and it has a lat long, and that's referenced with this database, and so we can find out what's nearby.
Also in your travel blog, in addition to writing about your trip to Vancouver for the Paralympic Games, you also wrote about going to the Consumer Electronics Show, the big show in Las Vegas that you go to every year. Any cool devices there for blind people, visually impaired people, or other disabled people?
Well, it's, again, the good news, bad news, because electronics are getting to be more touchscreen and inaccessible. And so I see cool things and, oh, shoot, I can't use that because it's got a flat screen or a touchscreen. I went last year with Stevie Wonder, and we were able to meet lots of manufacturers and to meet people that try to make a difference and to turn this technology around. And some things are starting to happen. The iPhone right now, you can switch it to a mode where that touchscreen talks as you feel your way around the screen.
So you know Stevie Wonder.
We're good friends for many years, and he's an amazing person, not obviously as a musician. I was with him last week in Washington, D.C., and sitting at his right hand at where he got an award, he was announced the U.S. Ambassador, U.N. Ambassador to Peace last year. And so we're working together on a lot of accessibility issues.
And finally, Mike, you told us a couple of weeks ago that you were going to be at the NPR headquarters in Washington on March 11th. That, of course, was a few days ago. Did that happen, and what were you doing there?
I've been there a number of times. I've rescheduled that meeting for April 1st, and I'm working with the Center on Public Broadcasting, where they have a lot of audio data that's being archived and then geocoded, which means, wouldn't it be cool if you're walking through Sacramento and some place where there was a civil rights march or audio story that was done could then be triggered as you went by it with your GPS. So we're looking at ways to work together and making our GPS technology marry up with all of the incredible archives of stories, the ones you've done and have been done around the country by NPR, have those referenced with a GPS so we can find them in terms of the location we're at.
What an amazing, cool idea that is.
It's great. NPR is amazing. Probably a lot of people don't know that there's a chief technology officer and that they're working closely to try to make accessibility of different devices like HD radios, NPR radios, something that everybody can use, blind people, even deafblind people, in terms of scrolling the information captions onto a Braille display. So I'm a member. I love the station, your show, and all the others that are done. And it's great to be able to contribute back as a technologist to work with NPR on some of these things.
Mike May, entrepreneur and technologist, as he just said. He's visually impaired. He's also a Paralympics medalist in skiing, and he was a delegate, a U.S. delegate, to the opening ceremony in the first few days of the 2010 Paralympic Games in Vancouver. Mike, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, and check out crashingthrough.com for more information on some of these things.
Okay. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, Narcissist Personality Disorder, the subject of a new book by a local psychotherapist. We'll be right back.